Hello, and welcome to episode 18 of the Heritage Connection, brought to you by the folks here at the Tower Heritage Center, home of the Washington County Historical Society in Washington County. Our mission is to forge meaningful connections across generations to Washington County's hardworking legacy, and this podcast is one more way we're trying to make those connections. I'm your host, Bella Bussey, and I'm joined by my co-host, Justin Nagar-Pratt. Justin, how's your week going?
Pretty good, thanks. I had a field trip earlier this afternoon, so a great group of third graders that I took through the buildings, and looking forward to having this conversation today.
Oh, awesome.
How about you?
Yeah, I'm having a good week too. The weather's good. A little bummy, but
I know.
Happy to
well,
be here.
Well, I have to tell you this, it's all downhill from here.
I understand.
Yeah.
A few days ago, the nation observed Veterans Day. And in this week's episode, we're going to continue that commemoration by discussing Washington County's role and participation in the Civil War. Last week, Justin mentioned the anniversary of Washington County's Doughboy statue, erected in 1927 as a memorial to veterans. Many names listed on it are of those who served in the Civil War. This week, we'll be digging into a few of those names, as well as a brief history on the war, while revisiting the overall experience of Washington County, Wisconsin's recruits. Thinking back in time, Justin, do you have any memories or moments that stand out to you when you first learned about the Civil War?
Yeah, you know, I feel like it's just, and this is obviously not true, I feel like it's just something I've always kind of known about. I mean, since I can remember back to when I was starting to learn about history, mm-hmm. like I knew there was a Civil War, and I knew like the very basic, you know, I guess maybe my earliest, strongest memory is probably like fourth grade.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, what about you?
The first thing that came to mind for me was being in high school and in AP US history and watching a lot of Crash Course History. Have you ever seen those videos?
No.
With John Green? He's an author and he knows a lot about it.
Like The Fault in Our Stars, John Green?
Yes.
Okay.
And he does a ton, like US history, European history, all kinds of stuff.
Really?
And they're like 10 to 12 minute synopses of big moments in history. And he does a really good job, and it helped me a lot because I rarely did the 4 hours of additional reading in high school.
Well, you know,
but
however you learn it, as long as you learn it, right?
Yeah.
Interesting. Oh. Hmm. Well, the American Civil War transpired between 1861 and 1865, which corresponded with the time frame of Abraham Lincoln's presidency. The Union, otherwise known as the Northern non-slave-owning states, fought against the Confederacy, the slave-owning states of the South. The battles of the Civil War cost the nation over 700,000 lives, making it the deadliest war for Americans in history, more deadly than both world wars combined.
Wisconsin's total losses were around 11,600, and the number accounts for those who died in action, from wounds and disease, even in accidents. Many of the men that enlisted from Washington County were under 21 years of age, and had to have a parent or guardian, most likely a father, sign off on their enlistment papers. The men had little to no basic training and recalled the war basically being a free-for-all. Uniforms were pretty much non-existent. The regiments wore whatever the group agreed upon, as the government didn't supply any clothing, not even a warm coat, until the later end of the war.
There also wasn't much to eat, and each soldier was required to cook for himself. Each man was given a ration of essentials, which included flour, tobacco, coffee, and salt pork, as well as an iron pan to cook on and carry around. Men reported some would mix everything up in their pan and gulp it all down. With poor diet and hygiene, it's no surprise that disease ran rampant throughout the army regiments. Illnesses like typhoid and other fevers, dysentery, and pulmonary ailments from gunpowder killed thousands. I'm really glad that you put in like the basics of the Civil War mm-hmm. in this, because I didn't realize like that they didn't have the uniforms.
Mm-hmm.
That's really fascinating. I just assumed I guess hearing myself say this, it doesn't make sense, but I just assumed like day one, it was like, okay, the Union's blue and the Confederacy's gray, and this is how we're going to identify everyone.
Mm-hmm.
And, but not the case, huh?
Well, that was said. That's true.
Okay.
But not everybody had the attire.
It didn't always make it.
Yep.
Got it. So that
mm-hmm.
was decided.
Mm-hmm.
But from the words leaving the person's mouth to the person actually getting the uniform, it didn't really happen all
mm-hmm.
the time, huh?
Right.
Fascinating.
Mm-hmm.
Huh.
Yep. And because things just weren't, you know, being supplied by the government either. So.
Right. Right. Yeah. Yep. Well, and as we'll talk about later on in this episode, there are a lot of lasting legacies of this war as far as like nationalization of certain things that we just kind of take for granted today.
Mm-hmm.
So I think this is a great introduction for folks.
Yeah. Thank you. Historians believe that the war began as a mixed result between a handful of issues, state rights, economic systems, and religious beliefs, to name a few, all of which ultimately stemmed from the most predominant and well-known controversy of the time, slavery. Although it was a major culprit, soldiers fought for many reasons other than slavery. For instance, to assist their battle brothers, preserve the Union, or even just to stay alive. As for the 200,000 African Americans that eventually bore arms during the Civil War, their main goal was most likely emancipation.
Although there was an increasing belief throughout the North that farmers and laborers should enjoy the wealth of their hard work, people in Washington County and other parts of the state had an unfortunate animosity towards abolition and the escaped slaves that ventured up to Wisconsin. A West Bend Post article dated November 1, 1862, and laced with racist sentiments read, quote, "White labor will be degraded, yes, utterly destroyed, if the issue of runaway slaves coming into the state is not thwarted," end quote. There was concern that introducing freed slaves into the economy would create competition for jobs in the mostly white free state of Wisconsin. Therefore, there was not much appeal to those who were poor and unemployed to fight in a war to end slavery. Many of the men drafted from Washington County were also immigrants. They had left countries like Germany and Austria to escape economic hardship and political unrest and weren't too keen on fighting a war shortly after arriving in America.
And that's something I never thought about before researching the Civil War, particularly in this county, is that it was very German and heavily influenced by immigrants. And I wouldn't want to go fight a war for a country I just moved into either.
Well, and a lot of them were escaping revolution at home.
They were.
And it's like, I've escaped war, and now you're asking me to go fight in a war for, like you said, a country, you know. That is something that I, you know, until I started working here, didn't really know much about. And boy, you know, the slavery issue, it wasn't just a, you know, cut and dry, clean, the North wanted one thing and the South wanted, you know, as with any issue, it was complicated, complex, and it could be different from person to person, town to town, home to home, you know, in the North and the South.
Yeah, absolutely. So the Confederacy really acted as its own nation when it pulled away from the Unionized States. They implemented their own taxes, had a government bureaucracy of over 70,000 people, and even created their own currency. The Confederate government passed America's very first Conscription Act, requiring the registration of every male citizen between the ages of 20 and 45 into the armed forces. It was later followed by the Enrollment Act of 1863 to meet the same recruiting requirements for the Union. Washington County actually did a really poor job of meeting their quota during the initial draft. It was both legal and common for draftees to pay someone else to take their place in the Army. There was a huge demand for substitutes, and rates paid to a substitute soldiers in Washington County were upwards of $1,000, which is equivalent to $19,000 today, the highest rates in the state. This was most likely due to the split support for the war and the many immigrants that felt removed from the pushed patriotic cause. The quota was also reported to be unfairly large in proportion to the population in comparison to neighboring counties, and a riot even broke out in front of the courthouse once in response to the draft in Washington County.
If you say the words draft riot, what war pops in your head? For me, it's the Vietnam War. I don't know how much you've said, right? Like, that's, and I think most people, if you say draft riot in Washington County, if you had to guess the war, I would have guessed Vietnam. I never, this is something I didn't learn about, obviously, until I started working here, is that there were, like, there was a big push against the draft. I always just kind of assumed that, you know, up until Vietnam, you got your orders and you went and you were happy and you were proud. And, but again, that's like way oversimplifying.
Yep, totally. And it wasn't just here, it was in neighboring counties, and like in Dodge County, a commissioner was killed due to a draft riot, and
and the whole like paying someone else to take your place was again like legal and just kind of a thing that happened. So it wasn't even, you know, that's why it's so important to look back in like the context of of history, right? Like through our 2023 eyes, mm-hmm. For those of you listening in the future, like that is not something that you would do.
Mm, absolutely.
I never realized, or I never really thought about the fact that the Confederacy, not only are they fighting a war, but they're also trying to set up this government that mm-hmm. they probably assumed was going to continue.
Right.
I mean, each state, in you know, had their own secession papers, and you can read them online, the original texts. They talked about why they were leaving the Union and what they were going to do, but I just never thought about the fact that they had all of that government building to mm-hmm. do.
Well, we're going to take a quick break and then return to discuss some of the firsthand experiences of Washington County soldiers in the Civil War. Welcome back. Before the break, we mentioned we'd be discussing the experiences of some of the Washington County soldiers that went off to serve the Union. Justin, would you be willing to tell us a bit about where they went after they left their hometown?
Yeah, so when Washington County troops were enlisted, many of them were shipped off to major cities, mostly Madison, to train. More than 70,000 soldiers prepared for war at Camp Randall in Madison. In order to accommodate those big numbers, the camp had 40 barracks, a hospital, officer quarters, stables, and a commissary. And a quick note, some of the spirited lyrics in the On Wisconsin hymn that Wisconsinites and fellow Badgers know well originated from a battle cry amongst soldiers that trained together at Camp Randall. Around 1,200 Confederate prisoners were also taken and held at Camp Randall. Many of them died from wounds and disease.
On the flip side, many Union soldiers from Washington County were held captive in some of the most infamous Confederate camps known to date. One of which was Robert Salter of Company G in Wisconsin's 26th Regiment. He and his brother William were Irish immigrants and fought together in the Battle of Chancellorsville. William was taken prisoner in Libby Prison of Virginia. He heard Robert became sick. Quote, Robert was taken very suddenly, since the second day did not recognize his friends. His pulse threaded and frequently reached 140 per minute. Treatment was whiskey and quinine. Soon after Robert died, William requested a furlough from his captors to be allowed to take his brother's body home, but was denied.
Apparently, there were many instances where brothers went off to war together. In fact, a news article from 1918 describes a group of five brothers that all returned home after the war. Now, the odds of that are incredible. They all came from what is now Farmington and were of the Rowe family. The article reads, quote, to write history of that family during the Civil War would take volumes. The brothers were nearly all wounded, and William, one of the brothers, is thought to be carrying a bullet in his body today, end quote. I really like that you got these stories because it brings it home. Because mm-hmm. even studying as a Wisconsinite, studying the Civil War, I mean, to be quite frank, every war that I've studied that the United States has been a part of just seems very far away.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm grateful that that is the case, right? Even today. But this really brings it home. Five brothers, and they all came back. The Rowe family.
It's just crazy for me to even think about how people just had so many children. And, you know, if they were all boys like that, you know, parents would just have to send them all away.
Mm-hmm.
To fight in the war.
Yeah. Yeah, and the Camp Randall and the On Wisconsin connection are really fascinating mm-hmm. as well.
Mm-hmm. Also, treating illness with whiskey and quinine. Just
yeah. And did you know quinine is used to help fight malaria?
Mm-hmm.
And that's where the gin and tonic came from.
Mm-hmm.
Because when the British were colonizing India, to encourage the, you know, taking your quinine, you know, just add some gin to it.
So basically, they were crafting cocktails to,
right.
to fight disease.
Yeah, yeah, there you go, win-win.
On the home front, parents, wives, and relatives would receive letters detailing both the adventures and horrors that soldiers experienced daily. Thomas Farmer wrote to his parents in West Bend about a skirmish from Wisconsin's 1st Regiment in Virginia. In 1881, he wrote, quote, the hails whistled about us like hailstones, but that made no difference to us. And the rebels fell like firing into a flock of pigeons. There were 2 killed in the Wisconsin regiment and 15 or 20 wounded. There were some 50,000 of us here now, Our boys are all right, although one of them can't stand very well, but I am the chap that can. Write soon, give my love to all, and if I don't get killed in the next battle, I will write again. Goodbye. End quote.
Gosh, what a way to end a letter.
I know.
Man. Yeah, and so much uncertainty. Well, and the way they were fighting those battles, and line up and shoot and hope you make it.
Mm-hmm, right. Yeah.
Well, spoiler alert, the Union of the North ultimately won the war. Not only did they outnumber the Army of the South 22 million to 9 million, they also led the nation in manufacturing goods and had more railroad coverage to get supplies and people across the country at faster rates. They also had more efficient agricultural systems, focusing on more mechanized farming than the South, which clearly favored and utilized free labor.
Though they weren't necessarily on the front lines, Wisconsin women also played a valuable role in the war. Middle and upper class women came together despite any political, ethnic, or religious differences at the time to form aid groups that supported soldiers. A group called the Women Soldiers Aid Society sent inspectors to improve hospital conditions and hired nurses to work in the hospitals. Women also rolled up their sleeves to take over agricultural and factory labor, keeping their families afloat while allowing food and supplies to be sent to soldiers. Between 1860 and 1870, the number of women in Wisconsin's industrial and commercial industries increased by 500%. A small collection of Wisconsin women even dressed as men and enlisted to fight alongside their sweethearts and relatives. Although all of this sounds great for females, there wasn't a long-lasting effect on women's rights after the war. A woman's race and class had a lot to do with how she was treated during wartime.
Although women held down the fort at home, almost 14% of soldiers who left Wisconsin to go to war did not return to them. Unfortunately, many young and previously healthy men died in drastic numbers. Without the use of dog tags, many remained on battlefields unidentified, which stunted any hope of closure to loved ones they left behind. If fallen soldiers were identified, their next of kin would have to wait to get word from death lists in the newspaper. Practices such as battlefield embalming, federal hospitals, and Memorial Day were instilled to help people cope with death. With the potential of many deaths in a single family, women were in a perpetual state of mourning, which required rituals that symbolized their grief. They would dress in dark garments and jewelry and drape black fabric over doors and cover mirrors. People could mourn anywhere from a few weeks to a few years. Some elderly women who lost both husbands and sons followed Queen Victoria of England's lead and mourned for the rest of their lives.
Though many who came from Washington County did not return home, a select few men who served lived to see many great milestones, recollecting their stories and continuing on to raise offspring that would become notable forces in the history of Washington County. Charles Silberzahn received a badge for his services in the Navy aboard the USS Argosy. He lived to be at least 90 and created the initial blacksmith company that was later sold to John Gale and turned into the worldwide machinery manufacturer it's known as today. Also in 1913, 320 Wisconsin veterans traveled from Milwaukee to Virginia to commemorate the Battle of Gettysburg on its 50th anniversary. Those who visited from Washington County included Captain G.O.W. Jones of Jackson and Gottlieb Metzner of Colesville. Matthias Ragner, who was also in Gettysburg, lost his leg in battle, but lived until old age and raised 8 children, including former Mayor Henry O. Ragner, for whom Ragner Park in West Bend was named after. A few others went on to celebrate 60-year anniversaries and even turning 100 years old.
And we actually have in our home front room on the first floor an exhibit that talks all about basically every war that's taken place since Washington County was formed. And there's a little display showing an example of a woman in mourning, the outfit, the black fabric draped over the door. Mm-hmm.
Creeps me out.
Yeah. I know. If you're here alone and you come around the corner, that, like, you know, it's not even a mannequin, but like the dress mm-hmm. is on like a, you know, a stand, and it does kind of catch you by surprise. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I had no idea either that so many, I want to say, famous names in Washington County were Civil War vets.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So it's interesting to think about how a lot of our history is rooted in whether or not some of them even returned home from the war.
Right. Yeah.
In the end, the Union won the bloodiest war to ever take place on American soil. Therefore, it only makes sense the nation followed how the Union believed the country should be run. Post-war, people began speaking of the United States as a singular entity instead of a plural. Instead of saying how the United States are a great place to live, it became the United States is a great place to live. War is also hashtag expensive, so the first progressive income taxes were introduced post-Civil War, as well as the first greenback national currency. The U.S. also turned into a more industrialized nation, beginning to devote more time and energy into skilled handicraft and artisanship. In Washington County, people were no longer stripping national resources, like timber and rawhide, to be sold on the market. Instead, they were honing in on their craftsmanship and manufacturing their own goods to be sold straight to consumers. A good example of this is the growth of the leather good manufacturing in this county, with the rise of the Engelcrest Pocketbook Company and other artisan companies following suit after the war. All of which goes to show the way in which we learn and think about the people and the moments of the Civil War can really shape how we view the way our county and nation exists today.
It's interesting about, you know, talking about the United States as plural versus singular. I didn't know that at all. We actually just did on Tuesday, a few days before this episode is released, did a class. One of our homeschool classes was all about leather making. Mm-hmm. So we talked about that. Engelcrest, Amity. Yeah, and you're right. A lot of those manufacturing companies kind of trace their roots to, you know, shortly after the Civil War.
Mm-hmm. And as I said before, I think it's overlooked sometimes how war affects smaller communities. Like, we know that war affects an entire nation in major ways, but it can also disrupt and create change in smaller environments. And I'm glad we were able to share a little bit of Washington County's story today.
Yeah, thank you for informing me and our audience of all these new things. I'm sure that people learned a lot. I know I did.
Mm-hmm. Well, moving on, we are going to move into a new segment called Tower Trivia. Name might change.
Yeah.
Today we're going to be testing Justin's knowledge on Civil War artifacts that we have in the Courthouse Museum.
Oh boy, all right.
First question, which of these Civil War artifacts is not in the museum? Answer A, genuine Civil War gunpowder horn. Answer B, a real set of Confederate and Union currency. Answer C, a dog tag of a Confederate soldier engraved with the name J.E. Malcolm. And answer D, a rosewood flute that belonged to a Union soldier in Wisconsin's 1st Regiment.
Mm. I'm going to say the dog tags because there weren't dog tags at this time.
It is the dog tag.
Which I didn't know.
You were paying attention.
When did they first start using the dog tags?
I don't know.
Oh, I don't know either. Well, we're going to have to find that out.
We'll figure that out.
Yeah. I've seen the flute. I think I've seen the powder horn.
Mm-hmm.
Currency, I haven't seen that. I didn't know about that.
Mm-hmm. Yep, we do have that. Oh. And the flute, too, is actually from Matthias Regner's general store, who we just talked about.
Right, right. And do we have his diary, too?
That's a different guy.
We have a diary. Okay, mm-hmm. Different guy. All right.
Question two. What color is the greatcoat that we have here in the museum, which was used as a part of a uniform in the Civil War? And to which side did it belong to, the Union or the Confederacy?
Well, it's blue, lighter blue, and it was a Union
coat.
It was. Apparently, it's really difficult to find complete Civil War era uniforms because a lot of the soldiers, if they survived, they went home and then they wore the uniform as like their everyday clothes. Like they'd go back to the farm and just wear it as like their work clothes. It wasn't like now or like during the, you know, after the World Wars, where you get home, you like tuck away your uniform in a chest and it becomes a family heirloom.
Mm-hmm.
That's what I was told by a teacher who knows a lot more about the Civil War than I do. So it's kind of
interesting. That's fascinating. I had no idea.
Yeah. Yeah. So if you ever see a complete Civil War uniform somewhere, that's a pretty rare set.
Yeah. And we have a coat.
We have a coat. Yeah.
Third question. There is a folding card table downstairs amongst the Civil War stuff. Who is it believed to have belonged to?
It's alleged to have belonged to Jefferson Davis, mm-hmm. the president of the Confederacy.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yep, that's true. And the donor daughter of Charles Silberzahn, who we also talked about, mm-hmm. claims that he pulled it out of the Mississippi River near Davis's plantation, mm-hmm. which is interesting.
Yeah.
But I guess we've tried to fact check that with his autobiography,
okay.
which states that he pulled a rocking chair out of the river, but not a table.
This is Silberzahn's?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, his autobiography. Got it. Biography. Okay. So it's a mystery whether or not it actually is his, but...
Yeah. And that is acknowledged in the text label. So
it is.
We always try... Yeah, yeah. We're not trying to pull fast one.
No.
Yeah.
Another question. We have a handmade silk flag in the museum. How many stars are on it?
Hmm. Well, I know it's not 50.
Mm-hmm.
Wisconsin was the 30th state admitted in 1848. I'm going to say 35?
34, actually.
34. Oh.
So close. Right after Kansas.
Is that the one that's in the case down there?
It is.
That's, okay.
Mm-hmm.
On the first floor but in our Civil War corner.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yep. Handmade okay. by a mother of a Union soldier. And she used just stuff she had lying around her house because mm-hmm. that's all that was available.
You can tell when you look at that. It's like, I mean, it's handmade.
Mm-hmm.
And it's from the Civil War, which mm-hmm. is incredible.
Yeah.
Yeah. And correct me if I'm wrong, it would be flown every time they received word of the Union winning a battle.
That's correct.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I hate to, like, make a correlation with the Cubs because, like, war and baseball are two completely different things. But it's kind of like when you see those W flags after the Cubs win,
mm-hmm.
which you don't see them very often up here, but,
yeah.
you know, yeah.
Are you a Cubs fan?
No.
Oh, okay.
just an observer. I have friends who are Cubs fans.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't want people to deface our sign. Craig Council Park up in Whitefish Bay. Yeah. I don't really have a horse in the race, actually, so,
yeah.
you know.
Yeah. Fair. Yeah. I have one final question for you, Justin.
All right.
We have two items that belong to Lieutenant George Jones of Jackson, Wisconsin. Name one of them.
Is that the diary?
It is the diary.
Mm.
Yep.
It's so small.
It's really tiny.
And the script is like very fancy. Like, I don't know how he wrote. I've never tried to read it,
Mm-mm.
but yeah.
Do we have it translated?
I don't know.
I don't know either.
Oh, well, yeah, that's the other reason I can't read it, because it's in German,
yeah.
and I don't read German. But, you know, what's the other object that we have? Do you know?
It's his sword, which...
That's his sword, okay.
And he carried with it in the famous battles of Gettysburg and Chancellorsville.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Oh, that's great. Kids love that sword.
Yeah.
I mean, as soon as we walk in that room, the kids on my field trip today, a sword! Yeah.
Weapons.
Uh-huh. Right. Yeah. I mean, it's big, it's shiny, and it's a sword, right? Mm-hmm. So that's, yeah.
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 Well, those are great questions.
Yeah. And if any listeners want to see what we're talking about, stop in for a tour. We have all the stuff.
That's right. Thursday, Friday, and Saturday, you can get into the 1889 Courthouse Museum, 11 to 5 Thursdays and Fridays, 9 to 3 on Saturdays. It's a self-guided tour, self-paced, and yeah, all of our Civil War stuff is in basic, I think. Is the currency on display?
Some of it is.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Wow. Well, I think like 99% of our Civil War collection is on display in that mm-hmm. room. It's not a lot, but it's important, obviously. So,
mm-hmm.
yeah, stop yeah. in.
And it's all stuff that came from right here, people that work from here.
That's right. And so. Then after you've listened to this, you can... bring, you know, your friend, your family member to the museum and try and stump them
mm-hmm.
on, although there are labels, so they'll probably be able to figure it out, but.
Mm. Create your own version of Tower Trivia.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Yeah, yeah.
Well, that concludes our very first game of Tower Trivia. Those were all the questions I had.
That was stressful. Actually,
did,
not really.
That you did great. I had fun.
Thanks. Yeah. It was a good introduction for me.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, I won't be so kind with you when it's your turn to be tested.
I'll be ready. Well, that concludes our episode about the Civil War. Thank you for tuning into this week's episode of The Heritage Connection, brought to you by the Tower Heritage Center, home of the Washington County Historical Society, whose mission is to forge meaningful connections across generations to Washington County's hardworking legacy. See you next time.